We are, of course, happy to see the meeting between President Xi and President Trump that have gone off well. And I think it sets the tone for the relationship between the two countries. And I think from this Shangri-La dialogue, it's quite obvious to all of us observing it. The officials from both sides are following the tone set. And I think this is a good basis for taking the relationship forward. So we look forward to that. But having said that, of course, we, all of us, including the US and the Chinese, would have understood that there are still issues to be resolved. But I think if we approach the challenges ahead with the right attitude, with the collaborative spirit, that speaks well for the chances of us getting to a better outcome than otherwise. So I think it's a positive outcome, but much work really remains to be done. On the participation for SLD, I think the value of SLD is best reflected in the participation and the networks being connected. So if I may use the analogy of an airport, the success of an airport is not based on whether a particular airline fly to the airport. The success of the airport is based on your number of connections that you can really connect up as different parties come. And if you are a hub airport like Singapore, your real competitive advantage is the ability for people to make more connections, right? And your real outcome is how many passengers can you carry, the equivalent of how many passengers can you carry. And for Shangri-La Dialogue, I think we are cheered by the support from many countries, a growing number of countries and organizations that come and participate. It shows that they find value in this event. They find value to use us as the platform to connect up with others. Now, then the next thing is that what are some of the tangible outcomes in the Shangri-La Dialogue? I know for our media friends, you would like to focus on some of the specific initiatives that's natural. But I would say that there are many layers of outcome that different people take from the Shangri-La Dialogue. So for example, perhaps I just use Singapore as an example, to use ourselves as an example. What does the Shangri-La Dialogue provide for Singapore and how does it lead to tangible outcomes? First, the ability to be in dialogue with so many partners to understand deeply what they are thinking. Not just what they do or how they do, but why they do what they do. That is invaluable. And I think for many other countries, it's the same. Because when we understand deeply why people do what they do, we reduce the chances of misunderstanding and miscalculation. Now, that is fundamental to defense. The second thing that I think many people take away from Shangri-La is what I call checking our own blind spots. If we just talk amongst ourselves, we may always come to the same conclusion. But in every Shangri-La dialogue, particularly during the ministerial roundtables, both yesterday and today, you get a chance to see how other people are dealing with the issues and whether there are things that we can learn from one another. For example, how countries from Europe to Southeast Asia and Oceania are dealing with non-conventional threats, information warfare, cyber threats, protecting of undersea cables, or how do we deal with even asymmetric warfare of the kinetic kind? How do we do it in a way that is cost-effective? And there are ideas that are being shared around. For example, yet another example, how do we do force transformation, embracing new technologies while conducting current operations? How do we organize our own structures and organizations, update our processes in order to embrace all these new technologies? Right? How do we mobilize and convince our people for the need to spend and invest in defense for the long term rather than the short term? So these are very useful things that happen behind the scene and in the ministerial lunches that we are able to share with ourselves in a open manner, because these are shared and common challenges. A third kind of outcome that we can get from the Shangri-La dialogue is, again, you may not see this, but where countries bilaterally or perhaps in small groupings have issues with another party, they are able to talk about it behind closed doors. And sometimes when nothing happens on the surface, it is a mark of success because some of those issues have been better managed or resolved. In defense, for us, very often, no news is good news. So we are not trying to create issues and then be seen to be resolving it. The art of defense is to be able to preempt issues before they are formed. Okay. A fourth way is sometimes you see that we announce tangible initiatives like the guide that we talked about. How did the guide idea come about? Well, it started from our conversations last year where we talked about critical underwater infrastructure, because today critical underwater infrastructures are not just carrying the critical waterways today, they are not just carrying trade on the ships, they are also carrying the critical underwater infrastructures that provide us the connectivities in terms of energy and data. So how did this come about? Because we started the conversation last year, and from that conversations through subsequent bilateral and multilateral conversations, we are able to get so many countries within the last 12 months to come on board to start this initiative. And what are we trying to figure out in terms in to go forward? Very clear. I said this in the session just now when we talk about the guide. Today, we have a bit of a gap in who has the right to lay the critical underwater infrastructure. We have gaps in how do we monitor the health, if you like, of the network? How do we deter bad people from wanting to do bad things to the network? Because we are able to share information and see them doing such things. And finally, if we catch people doing bad things to our network, what can we do about it as an international community? So to discuss all this and to put in place a mechanism is our way of protecting our infrastructure and a way of deterring other people from attempting even to do this, right? So these are some of the examples of how the Shangri-La dialogue is useful to different parties, and different parties will have different takeaways at different levels. China's participation, and I'll just like to perhaps encourage people not to use this phrase, low-level Chinese participation. I personally don't like this. I personally don't look down on people and cast them as whether they are low-level or high-level. I think we respect the Chinese participation. The Chinese participation will be determined by their own considerations, and different years, they have different levels of participation. First, it's not that the Chinese are not here, and I think the Chinese delegations have made their presence felt in many of the plenary sessions, and please do not call the Chinese level. I don't think you like people to call you low level. I never really like this word. So maybe just a request to the media. For us, we take all participation, whether it is the ministerial level, the permanent secretary level, the academic think tank level, we take them all seriously and we treat them with respect. That's part of the Shangri-La's DNA. If I shift gear a bit, I think there are a few consistent messages that comes up from all the discussions, particularly from the plenaries and the ministerial roundtable. And that applies to, I think, many countries. It applies to us as well. And I meant it seriously in my summary, that the first takeaway is this. If you just talk and you don't follow up upon it, and you don't do anything about it, then nothing is going to come up and people will become cynical. But you just keep doing, and as one of you have suggested, you think you're making yourself more secure by increasing your defense spending or building new capabilities, but you do not correspondingly step up the efforts to mutually assure each other, then there will be a lot of suspicion. So if you don't talk and you don't do, nobody can help us. So I think the correct answer is that we must both talk and do at the same time. Each of us must pull our own weight for us to be a credible partner, for us to be a relevant partner for others. And each of us, as we whether increase our defense spending or whether we build new capabilities and become a more relevant partner, we must spend the time and effort to reassure others of our intention. The more powerful we are, the more effort we need to spend to reassure others. Because ultimately in the defense sector, people look at not just capabilities, people look at intention. Now the next point is, spending more on defense is of course part of the conversation, but it is not the entire conversation. And this point was also made in the ministerial roundtable. It's not just how much we spend on defense that matters. It is also how we spend the money that matters. For example, in many of the new technologies that we are looking at, it is not how much you spend, but how innovative your ideas are, how much bang for the buck you get for the same or less expenditure. It is not true, and I have been in the defense sector for the last almost 40 years, there is no linear correlation between expenditure and capability. Different countries spend different amounts, different countries use their expenditure differently, wisely, to build up capabilities of according to their needs, right? And this is the same thing for Singapore, and I have said this before when people ask me about where is our defense expenditure going, which direction. We will spend as much as we need in order to make ourselves capable of defending ourselves and a relevant partner to others. But what are the capabilities that we need? Is it a straight line linear correlation with defense expenditure? I don't think that is true, and it's not a linear correlation. A lot of the time, what is even more important is that we spend the money consistently over the years to build up real capabilities, particularly on the human capital side. It takes years to train a pilot, a sailor, and so forth. It takes even more years for us to build up the scientific community, the technological capabilities, in order to translate some of those spending into real capabilities. And therefore, we should not go away with the simplistic thinking that it's a linear correlation between spending and capabilities. Some countries spend a lot, but they do not get commensurate capability. Part of the reason is that because if you adopt a feast and famine strategy, you don't stretch your defense dollar and you don't get bang for buck. So this is one of the challenges. In fact, in the ministerial roundtable, we also discussed this. How do you convince the public to spend consistently rather than have a feast and famine strategy and spend only when the trouble starts? By then, most of the time, if not all the time, it's too late. And now with the new generation of technologies available, it is even more important for us to be discerning in how we spend, right? Okay, so that goes into the spending. ASEAN is not and must not be complacent. Yes, we are relatively more fortunate compared to many other regions that are having conflicts, kinetic conflicts now. But ASEAN must never be complacent. ASEAN must be very clear in our perspective, where are those challenges today and where are those challenges tomorrow? We have to deal with not only today's challenges, we have to deal with tomorrow's challenges. How do we establish the frameworks to deal with those issues? How do we build the trust for us to work together on those issues? How do we build real capabilities to deal with those issues? That's why I said in my speech that circumstances don't define us. Our responses to circumstances define us. Right? Now, that is to do with spending. Let me go. Okay. So Aslan, to your questions about whether is it more or less talk, I think we have answered that. Now, for the critical underwater infrastructure, I will take it slightly one step back. Today, all the critical channels, all the critical sea lanes, they are so important to so many countries, not just because of the trade volume that goes through them. They are also critical arteries of the global system where there are pipelines of energy, there are cables for internet traffic. And if any of this disrupted, can you imagine that Singapore is digitally cut off from the world? Can you imagine Singapore is unable to access our essential supplies like food and energy? This would have very serious implications on our lives and our livelihood. So why are we spending so much effort working with like-minded partners? It's because we want to make sure that all these basic components of what makes life normal continues to be normal. Otherwise, we might soon find ourselves in quite a different position. You take a simple event like this. For us to keep the lights on, for us to bring the essential logistics, for us to make sure that bad actors do not disrupt the event, there are so many processes that are required behind the scene for us to make it seem normal. And that is why, before I started this event, 2-3 days back, we walked the ground, we checked everything, we thanked the people, and I'm going to thank the people behind the scene again after this. Because for everything that looks so easy and seamless, there are a lot of work behind the scene. You talk about deterrence and how we build capabilities. Well, there's a Chinese saying, 害人之心不可有, 防人之心不可无. And I think this applies to the defense. Do not set out to try to harm people, but also do not be naive that we do not need to take care of our own defense. So that, I think, is a good reminder for us on how we conduct defense. And I think through the Shangri-La Dialogue, we hope to achieve that by giving space to people to discuss their issues frankly so that we do not need to make news unnecessarily. So finally, I think it was everything that I summed up in my closing remarks just now at the plenary sessions. And I will just emphasize that again, because you have words without action, then nothing is achieved. But you have action without communication, then trust is destroyed. And if you have no action and no communication, everything is impossible. But if you combine action and communication, then nothing is impossible. I think the Chinese version rhymes a bit better. Okay, I hope I have answered your questions and given you some food for thought. And I hope you also help us to spread the message of the challenges that we have, the commitment that we have to overcome them, and ultimately, defense is a whole of society business. Defense is a long-term business, and it's a privilege for me to have known many of my counterparts for so many years. It allows us to communicate frankly, openly. And I would say that I'll let you into a little secret. Even when one of my closest counterpart, he wasn't able to be here at this Shangri-La conference because of other pressing domestic issues, we called each other. We kept each other informed of the progress as we went along, even though he may not be able to be here. And that is how tight we want our relationship to be, because we are in constant communication with one another to share notes so that we minimize the chances of miscalculations, misunderstanding, and it builds and it plants the seeds for mutual understanding to take actions in real time.